Thanks for tuning in to the Lean 911 podcast, where you'll have a voice directly from the Gemba. I will rely on my three decades of Lean successes, as well as my failures, to answer your most challenging questions regarding your Lean transformation. I'm your host, Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons Consulting, and the principal architect of the Danaher Business System. Looking forward to your questions. Now, let's go to the Gemba.
Welcome to episode 40. I'm Mark DeLuzio, President and CEO of Lean Horizons. And today, his second appearance on our podcast, Art Byrne, senior executive at Danaher, and then took Wiremold after he left Danaher to all kinds of heights. I think Wiremold is one of the best Lean turnarounds that I've observed, probably better than some of the companies at Danaher. And Art and I go back, well, to 1987. That's a few years ago, when he and George Kronesaker hired me as a finance guy at one of the legacy companies at Danaher that started this whole thing called Jake Break, and where we brought in Shingajitsu, the five guys that were the first lieutenants of Takashi Ono who implemented the Toyota Production System. And we were the first ones to bring them over. And Art and I are going to have an episode coming up that's going to talk about the early days of Danaher and what that was like and what we had to face and all the things that we had to go through with a UAW workforce type of thing and how we had to change our mindset and listen to what we were being told. So that's going to be another episode. By the way, Art, the last one that we did, we talked about your book, The Lean Turnaround Answer Book. I'm holding it here if you're looking on YouTube or Rumble. I would probably say this book is, if you want to learn about Lean and you want to understand what this is all about, if you don't get this book, you're going to be in disarray because there's so many things in here that perhaps I was just talking to Art earlier before we started. Each one of the topics in here could be an episode all by itself. Some of them could be a whole book by themselves. And this book, to me, I'm going to be recommending to all my clients as well, because it basically talks about all the different things you did with LEI, Lean Enterprise Institute. You had these papers, and you put them all into a book, which is a really smart idea. So if you want to know about Lean and understand all the questions that are being asked, this one here, to me, is on top of the list. Okay. So Art, my friend, how are you doing? You're calling from Boston at this point.
That's right. Thank you, Mark. How are you? Nice to be with you again.
Yeah, no, thank you. And I think today you said we wanted to talk about Lean culture and what does that all mean and how do you establish a Lean culture? I remember Art was the CEO of Wiremold, and he and George Kronesaker, the guys that really started the whole transformation at Danaher that eventually led to the Danaher Business System, which is, as we all know, pretty monumental. But nobody talks a lot about Wiremold, you know, because Wiremold, after you sold the business, got took over by another company that just kind of undid a lot of stuff that you did. And so all that cultural stuff that we're going to talk about kind of went away. And I know leadership is really important in that regard. So, all right, let me turn it over to you. Lean culture. What the heck is lean culture? What does that even mean?
Well, I think that, you know, the whole thrust of this is about if you can get yourself to where you have a lean culture, you're going to be almost impossible to beat. You're going to be very hard to compete against. And so, you know, people say, well, what do you mean? How do you define lean culture? And, you know, some of the academic professors and whatever, there's a guy named Edgar Schein that's fairly famous, and he defined culture, business culture, as companies that have a shared set of values, goals, attitudes, and practices that everybody in the company can kind of get on board with and agree with. Of course, I think in a little simpler fashion than the academic professors. So I just think of lean culture as, well, culture in general as the way we do things here, right? And you know, that's the way we started out at Wiremold was how do we change the way things were happening before, because Wiremold was a traditional batch company. It had a functional organization. and it batched everything. You know, it had a make the month kind of culture. It wasn't so bad on the, you know, when things went wrong, the first question that you ask was who. It wasn't too bad on that, but it was very, very functional. And if you're going to change to lean, and then after that a lean culture, you got to change that structure. You're going to lean because lean is value stream structure, not a functional structure, and it's a flow operation, not a batch operation. And so you have to understand before you even start that everything that you've done before has to change. And that's a big hurdle for a lot of people, really, is what do you mean everything has to change? Most of the companies that I see, and I assure you run into this all the time, Mark, is they think of lean as just a cost reduction program. They don't think of it strategically at all. And so they're not going to get very far, even if they're very diligent working on it. So I think, you know, to start on the lean culture, first of all, lean to get into lean, to convert to have a lean culture, first of all, you have to convert to lean. And so let's start with that, because when you look at that, you know, lean has to be led. You can't manage lean, you can't delegate it. It has to be led. The leader has to be out front and hands-on, and very, very involved. In fact, I always say the lean leader has to commit to becoming a lean expert, because if you don't, how are you going to challenge your organization for what's possible if you don't know what's possible yourself?
How do you know what questions to ask, right? I mean, how do you know the right, even what you're looking at, if that's the case? Exactly.
That's right. So the lean has to be led. And to begin with, I think the first step really is the leader has to communicate, why do we want to change to lean? What do we expect as results? When are we going to do it? And how are we going to do it? Because people have to have upfront, they have to understand, why are we going to make this big change? What's in it for me? And why are we going to do it? What do we expect for results? And in order to help set those results and what we expect, I mean, you can talk about what other companies have done and what kind of thing results they've gotten. But I think a really key thing, if you're going to change the culture, is you got to set operational excellence goals that people can understand. That's sort of like, what are we trying to do here anyway? And the operational excellence goals are going to tell everybody, this is what we're trying to do. And as an example, when I first got to Wairamo, we set five key operational excellence goals. And they were all very stretched targets. The first one, we wanted 100% on-time customer service, not 97.3 or something like that, but 100%. Well, a lot of people are, you laugh, but a lot of people are satisfied when they get to 96 or 97%. And we just said, no, that's not the culture that we want. That's not what we're looking for.
All right,
And then,
what Nicole, either Nicole A. Watts, our mentor, your mentor of mine, said to me one day, Lucio-san, why are you setting 95% on-time delivery? And I gave him some crazy excuse. He said, why are you planning on failing? He said, why don't you call the 5% right now and tell them that you're going to be late? And that's a mindset shift. Okay.
Absolutely.
And that's one of the things that we got hit right in the head with on that. Yeah.
Well, I think that's the reason, in my opinion, why you want to set stretch goals as operational excellence targets, not wimpy goals, because you want to change the mindset. And changing the mindset doesn't happen if you just set incremental goals. It's not going to happen. So we set 100% on-time customer service, 20% productivity gain every year, 50% reduction in defects every year, 20 times inventory turns as the first target. And then we said we wanted visual control in the 5S everywhere. So, you know, when you lay that on an organization that's been traditional batch, they just think that's crazy. And for example, at Wairamo, we were at 3 times inventory turns when I said, okay, our target's 20. Because I knew that if I said we're going to go from 3 to 5, I wouldn't get very far. They just think they could keep doing what they were doing. But if you got to
Right.
go, if you got to go from 3 to 20, you got to change the way you think about things. You got to change everything, which is one of the things that's going to drive culture, is big goals like that. And after a while, what happens after a while is people get used to these big targets. If we get everybody aimed at these targets, they just become natural. It's just a normal thing within this company. It goes back to what I said to begin with, that culture is just the way we do things here. And those targets are just the things that we're trying to do here. No big deal. And so once we got the operational excellence targets, the next major thing to do really is we had to change the structure. You know, we had to go from this functional layout and organization to a value stream layout and organization. So we created value streams. And in our case, a value stream really was a product family. We had about 7 product families that were kind of distinct. So we created value streams, a product family. We picked value stream leaders. And these were people that we just thought had high potential to run a small business. They weren't out of manufacturing necessarily. We had a lady out of order entry. We had a lady out of, I don't know, I think production control or someplace. We had, oh no, she was out of quality. I think we had a marketing guy. We had our auditor, the financial auditor for the corporation. So we had very different types of people that we made, all of a sudden we made you a value stream leader. And this was before, we created this before we did, before we moved anything or before we did any Kaizens, because we wanted that structure in place, because it sent a big signal to people that, oh, things are going to be different, number one. And number two, we needed somebody who would receive and be responsible for maintaining the Kaizens once we did them. And that was going to be the value stream leader. We call him the team leader. Sure. And so we created that structure to begin with. And that meant that if you had a product family, we were going to give you all the equipment necessary to make that product family complete, from raw material to in the box. Now, of course, we were in a functional layout physically, so that meant we had to move every piece of equipment. And we moved a lot of it 2 or 3 times to get it to where the product family could be together and the equipment. And we made the team leader sit out on the shop floor next to that equipment. So all of this stuff is very dramatic for the rest of the organization. Like, oh my God, what's going on? What's happening? So they got these big stretch targets, and now we're going to upside down the whole organizational structure. So this starts to create change, and this is what you want. You start to create this change. We also established a strong Kaizen promotion office, again, using internal people. Back at that time, we couldn't go out. This was like 1991. We couldn't go out and hire a bunch of Kaizen experts to create a Kaizen promotion. There wasn't anybody out there like that yet. Right. So we had to train them in-house, and we picked people that we thought had high potential to move higher in the organization. And then we had them stick with Shin-Jujitsu when we had them in for the Kaizen, so they could learn from Shin-Jujitsu. And when Shin-Jujitsu wasn't with us, we had them organize and run Kaizens all the time. We were trying to do 2 Kaizens per week per facility. And that's a lot of Kaizens, I can tell you. We couldn't do it all year round, because in the summertime, that was our busy season, and we couldn't give up the equipment. But the rest of the year, we could do it. And in the summer, we did more of a office Kaizens and things like that. So we still had a high level of Kaizens, but they just couldn't be on the shop floor. So once we established the Kaizen promotion office and started doing Kaizen was the real way that we changed the culture, because we got everybody involved. Everybody was going to be on a Kaizen. Every Kaizen team had a mixture of hourly and salaried employees. And that really, you know, and every Kaizen, of course, gave us huge results. You know, when you do a Kaizen, you're going to reduce the space by 50%. You're going to reduce the inventory by 70%, maybe cut the manpower needed by 50%, on and on and on like that. So when people see these enormous results coming after only 1 week of doing it, you know, we averaged a 90% reduction in setup time in 1 week on any type of equipment. Now, you can't spend a lot of money in 1 week. So people were just shocked by this. They just, you know, but that started to change the culture. They started to think, wow, look what's going on here. This is pretty amazing. We never thought this could be possible. And I'm involved. You know, whether I'm an hourly person, a salary person, I'm involved. People want my opinion, want me to help find the waste and eliminate it. So that starts to change the culture a lot. You know, we took a 150-ton punch press with a 5-position progressive die. from 3 hours and 10 minutes, for example, to 1 minute. You know, now that's pretty shocking when you think of it. And of course, the operator, if you were the operator and you were spending 3 hours and 10 minutes, and all of a sudden you're only spending 1 minute, you get that. You understand, hey, this is better for me, and it's going to be better for our customers as well. We reduce the cost and we shorten the lead time dramatically by doing things like that. And then
Hey,
we, so.
let me interrupt for a minute. Let me ask, what about that operator that says, hey, I'm going to lose my job? How do you handle that?
Yeah, well, the whole, you know, I always looked at this from the point of view that management's response, management has, to me, three main responsibilities to its people. One is protect their jobs, make sure they don't lose their job. Two is increase their skill, right? Give them more opportunity to gain more skill so they have more value if they ever wind up on the outside. And three, give them a chance to share in the gains that they are going to help create. And so that be, you know, when they understood that that's how we thought, that also helped help create some of the cultural change that we wanted to have. But it wasn't enough. So early on, we created what we and publicized to everybody what we call the Wiremold core values. And again, we try to keep it simple. The core values for Wiremold were three things: people, customers, and Kaizen. Okay. And it's really been a sort of saying that our people using Kaizen are going to deliver more value to our customers. But those three things, people, customers, and Kaizen, we posted on all our stationery. We had it on the wall. We preached it to our people so they understood what we were trying to do in addition, you know, and we were driving those operational excellence goals to make that happen.
Well, you know, I'm going to stop you there for a minute. I mean, a lot of people might have thought that third one would have been shareholders, people, customer. I know you're a private company, but you know, owners, profits, and that's not there. What you
Nope.
said was people, customers, Kaizen, and
Right.
those are the leading indicators that drive profits.
Right. But those are the things that are going to create value for the shareholder.
Right.
So, I mean, we looked at it from the point of view, if you think about most traditional companies, they're driven by this concept of make the month, right? And so 3 weeks after the month ends, they finally close the books, and then they spend 2 or 3 or 4 days having a big financial review of something that already happened. You can't do anything about it now, so you're wasting your time spending a lot of time looking at what happened before. The only thing that's going to change what happens going forward is if you change the processes that created last week's results, last month's results. And so we just focus people on, we're going to focus on processes all the time. And, you know, lean, of course, is learned by doing. And so getting everybody on Kaizens and doing lots of Kaizens, there was a lot of learning going on across the whole company. And this learning was creating the culture change because people were starting to think differently. They were starting to see things differently. And then we said, okay, we created the core values. Now we need to know, we needed to tell people, what do we expect of them? You know, what's the behavior we expect from you when you come to work every day? So we created the what we call the Wiremold Code of Conduct. And I can even hold it up for you. It's a little, we put it on a wallet-sized card, and we made it really simple. We said, look, when you come to work, we expect these things. One, respect others. Two, tell the truth. Three, be fair. Four, try new ideas. Ask why. Keep your promises and do your share. Very simple. A lot of those things, like ask why, were all part of the why that we were teaching people with Kaizen and with Lean. But it's a very simple code of conduct. That's what we expected from when you showed up to work. And people took that to heart. They carried these in their wallets, and we posted on the wall and all that. But you know, things like that, they're not enough unless management really walks the walk and talk, you know, not just not talk the talk, but you really back that up and you behave that way yourselves. So we did that, and part of having a code of conduct like that sort of obligated us to get rid of all the bad actors. I mean, every company has a few bad actors. It's not a lot of them, you know, but you have them, and they've been around a long time, and so you got to put in the effort to get them out. And in our particular case, we had a union, we had the IBEW. So getting the bad union workers out, that was going to be a task. But we said, well, we have to do it because they're dragging down everybody else. And it was really interesting. Every time we finally got someone out that had been a bad actor, the rest of the team looked at us and said, gee, what took you so long? So, you know, again, that helps with the cultural change because people say that, hey, they're serious. You know, this guy, he was dragging down our team and he wasn't doing anything and he was bad mouthing everybody. And we're really glad that person is gone. You know, now we can, you know, go forward as a team, because, you know, as you know, converting to lean, it's a team sport. It's, you have to have the whole team. You can't do it with the top 20 people in the company, or the top 40 or 50. You got to use everybody. And so everybody has to be on the team and everybody has to understand what it is we expect. So this focusing on processes, not results, was a big cultural change, really, because, you know, everything we did, we basically, you know, we ran the company on our operational excellence goals. Before, you know, when we were thinking in a make the month mode, you know, we tended to run the company based upon, you know, the monthly results. And so now we changed that. We had these five operational excellence goals that I mentioned. They're all stretch targets. And so what we did is we just said, okay, we deployed those down to the team leaders, the product family leaders, the value stream leaders, if you will. And every week, myself and my senior staff met with all seven of the value stream leaders. They each had 10 minutes to present how they were doing on these five things. And the next thing they had to do was tell us what Kaizen things they were planning on for the next week. That was all. They only had 10 minutes to do this. And we were, because that was myself and my whole staff, you know, we could make decisions on things that they brought up right away. We didn't have to go through any big process. We were all in the room. And so we could make changes really, really fast. And this was I thought a really major change in terms of how things functioned and how things were. I think it's a much better way to run your company, by the way, because now you're focused on the process. And if you think of it, you know, when you organize by value streams, by product families, in our particular case, the product family leaders, they had reporting to them about 85% of all of our people, right? So if 85% of my people are all focused on only five things every week, and we review it every week, I get everybody kind of going in the same direction, which is exactly what we wanted to have happen. And so, you know, I think, you know, I mean, we did other things. We created a suggestion program, and we created an annual employee survey, and we followed up on that. And we did some of those kind of traditional things as well. But I think the main thing was really, you know, setting the operational excellence targets, organizing by value stream instead of functional. And then from there, it was just Kaizen, Kaizen, Kaizen. That was the Kaizen is the way you learn, the way you do things, the way you eliminate the waste. So we just ran a ton of Kaizens, and everybody was on a Kaizen. And
nobody is doing Kaizen anymore. I had an episode on my earlier podcast, episode on this podcast a while back. It said, what happened to Kaizen? And everybody's got these Gemba boards, and they got posters and yellow tape and all this. And he asked them, well, what's your Kaizen process look like? Well, kind of busy. We're backlogged. We got a lot of stuff going on. And, you know, we don't really have a lot of time for that. And I'm thinking, well, how are you going to get better? I mean, it's like the analogy I use is Arnold Schwarzenegger not wanting to go to the gym, but he wants to become Mr. Universe, right? And you've got to do Kaizen. It's on the bottom of the PPS house, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
It's mind-boggling. Mind-boggling.
But think of it. It's really just human nature, right? I mean, people will want to do the things that are easier. Kaizen's hard. And so they're going to, you know, first of all, they'll think about, well, you know, it'd be easier if we do something like Six Sigma. We'll train a bunch of guys. We'll give them black belts and green belts, and then we'll occasionally.
Oh, well.
Or, Or, instead of Kaizen's old fashioned, we'll do A3 or we'll do something like that where you don't have to move any equipment. You don't have to have any disruption in the factory. You do this. They're all like planning exercises. They're not any doing exercises, right? I mean, I remember, years, it was years after Danaher and, well into Wiremel, maybe even after Wiremel, before I ever even heard of A3. I said, A3, what's A3? And then when I understood what it was, I said, oh, that was just the first page of every Kaizen that we did that Shinjujutsu taught us. They taught us how to create an A3 to start off the Kaizen. But they just never called it A3. I never knew what it was, but we used it all the time, as you saw it from the beginning with them. But I never, so we never did that. But now people have taken A3 not as the starting point for Kaizen, but as just some sort of planning exercise, just sort of some way to tell other people how things are and what do we want them to look like. But there's no plan to change to how to get to make them look like that, which is what.
I walked into a potential client once and went to the conference room, and I swear there must have been, if there weren't 100 A3s on the wall, there were, okay. And I looked at all of them, and it was the size of a company like Daybreak, maybe, and I said to the CEO, I said, which of the 10 of these are the most important that you really got to work on? And he couldn't answer. They were
Yeah.
just doing lean. They weren't really implementing, they were doing all the motions and all these people doing all this busy work and but nothing was getting done. It's incredible. Anyway.
Yeah. Well, that's just the human nature. It's the same with, as with Six Sigma. You got 20 steps in a process. Six Sigma focuses on one, and the other 19 stay the same. So not much happens in the end, really. They maybe clear up a bottleneck, but otherwise not much happens. But they
No,
think that
you're
was.
smart because I actually, and this is public knowledge, I could talk about this. GE Money back in 2005, I went in and they had the retail credit card process. We value streamed and looked at it, and it was a 63-day lead time. And for 1 hour's worth of work, okay, 1 hour of process time, okay? And
Wow.
they said, do you want to see the Six Sigma stuff that we did on this so far? And I swear to God, they brought me a stack of 8.5 by 11 paper about, well, 8 inches thick. Every page filled with all the data and all this, right? So when I looked at, I said, I put it aside. I said, they weren't looking at the 63 days. They were trying to take the hour down by 15 minutes. And okay, I'm not saying there's no merit in that. That wasn't the game. The game was, how do we get this down? Now they wanted to go to 20 days. And I said, no way, I'm leaving if you want to do 20. One day, I'd say, not even too long. One day lead time. We got it done in one day. And you know that generated a $216 million growth in that business in the first year. Okay. Because
Not
customers
surprising.
were taking off, going somewhere else. Yeah. And it was like they were so misaligned, but nobody wanted to tell Jack Welch he had no clothes on, right?
Yeah.
If you try to do anything with lean, you would have been fired. And people have told me that there.
Yeah. Yeah, I did it. I had a similar experience with a life insurance company once where they asked me to look into, they were having a problem with, it was taking them 48 days to respond to a request for insurance. In other words, to underwrite the next case, right? 48 days. And I said, well, what's the rest of the industry? And they said, well, the rest of the industry is around 40 days, so we need to get down a little bit. And I said, no, you got to get down to like 5 days or less. And they said, that's crazy. And I said, all right, well, let's look at it. How long does it take for an underwriter to underwrite a life insurance policy if he has all the information, he or she has all the information? They said, we don't know. I said, what do you mean you don't know? You're the underwriting department. Well, we never looked at it like that. It turned out that that could be done in about 15 minutes if you had all the information, right? And I said, that means an underwriter should be able to underwrite 150 lives a week. How many are they doing now? They said 15. So you just say, come on, guys, this is crazy, So I set up a cell with, four case managers and one underwriter, and we got the underwriter to be able to do 88 lives a week instead of 15. And they brought the turnaround time down to 20 days. And I said, look, now that you got it to 20 days, the path to 5 days is very clear. So the problem was it was only clear to me. It wasn't too clear to them.
All right, your mistake was you should have implemented Six Sigma, theory constraints, demand flow technology. What else is out there?
A3.
Okay, you got to do all that stuff, right? And it's just incredible how the, yeah, and I said to you earlier that you and I, when you hired me in 1987, we had no other consultants out there to screw us up, thank God.
Right.
We only had Team Jiu-Jitsu. We didn't have all these crazy consultants that a lot of these guys want to be, they're Ono wannabes or they're Demi wannabes. And they try to take the same thing, they repackage it, they confuse the hell out of people. And there's a lot of confusion. And I'm a guy that just says, do the freaking basics. You talk about standard work, okay? Do the basics and don't look for any kind of silver bullet because there aren't any. But a lot of consultants want to sell these silver bullets. A lot of people call me. They say DBS is a silver bullet. No, it's not. Okay? It's a lot of hard work, as you described. And by the way, you can't do DBS. If you want to do it, go work with Dan. You got to do your own thing. Looks like you did at Wormhole.
Yeah, well, you before you came, we had used Arthur Anderson Consulting to start the Lean program.
I was here for the overlay on that. I remember that.
I mean, and of course, they were big, you know, PowerPoint presentations. Lots of these sharp young guys, cost a lot of money, took a lot of time, you know. And the cells that we created, we only created a couple, but mostly that was because of what Konosaker and I were doing. And they didn't work very well, but we did get to some cells. But we were really already fed up with them by the time we got a hold of Shinjitsu. And then when Shinjitsu came, of course, they changed everything. You know, no more PowerPoint presentations, no presentations at all. Let's just go out on the shop floor. They look on the shop floor, they turn around and say, everything here is no good. What do you want to do? And that was it. That's how you start.
Well, you know, it's interesting how you talked about art. And I got a whole list of things I'm just going to run through at the end of this. But you talked about going into these value streams. And there's a lot of different ways to think about value streams. One way, of course, is product families, which makes sense. And that's what we did at Jakebreak. So, yeah, when we morphed into what we now call lean accounting, which I developed at Jakebreak, and I remember you had Ori Fumi call me, your CFO, to say, hey, what are you doing over there? You can't really do lean accounting until you get rid of the batch and queue mentality and go to value streams. You know, almost the accounting has to follow what happens on the shop floor. If you're, right. I had a company in Florida call me, hey, we want to do lean accounting. We know you're the father of lean accounting. And I asked them three questions, and they said, you can't do it. They're still doing MRP, Ollie White, single operation, functional batch scheduling, no single point scheduling that pulls through. They've got the big warehouses, they got work orders, they got all the things that are just, you know, but they said they were doing lean, okay? And I said, you guys can't do it. There's no way you can do what I call lean accounting in a batch and queue environment. Yeah. I mean, I'll come and help you get out of that. If that's what you're interested in, that's what we do. And then we could talk about lean accounting. But how can you do it when you have this MRP, Ollie White, EOQ mentality? You can't do it.
Yeah, that was kind of one of the reasons why at Wormhole, one of the very first things we did after we set out the operational excellence targets was right away, we created these value streams, you know, organizations. Now, you know, the equipment was still all in batch. The equipment hadn't moved yet. We hadn't really done much of any Kaizen, but we needed to create the organizational structure first. And one of the interesting things in that organizational structure was not only did we create a team leader for a product family, but then we got rid of our purchasing department and our production planning department, and we took one person and made them the what we call the buyer planner. And the buyer planner sat next to the team leader for that product family. You know, because like most companies, we bought five or six key materials in huge amounts, et cetera. So we can negotiate the you know, the price of that from our vendors at a higher level, you know, so like an annual contract or whatever. And then the buyer planner could release against that. But anything unique to their product family, they were responsible for buying. And they were responsible for any kind of scheduling. Now, as we moved from batching to flow and lean, the scheduling changed. We weren't, you know, making to a forecast anymore. We were making to the orders coming in from the customer every day. So then the planning part became we're capacity planning, number one, and number two, trying to figure out on the seasonal aspects of the business. For example, we were at one level for 8 months and a 30, 40% higher level for the next 4 months. And so we had the planner had to add Kanban cards into the system in order for us to meet that demand in the summertime when we had the high demand. Because we finally, you know, as we made the change, we got to the point where you couldn't make anything without a Kanban card. You know, and that was a difficult shift because everything before was on MRP and batch and whatever. And so we had to make that shift. We bought a new enterprise system and we said, okay, we want the value of the enterprise system. The only thing is the shop floor cannot be run on MRP. It has to be only on Kanban. And so to do that was a job because first of all, we had to create a Kanban quantity for every item that we sold. And we had like 35,000 SKUs. So that took a while. And, you know, sometimes the Kanban quantity was a whole pallet worth. Sometimes it was a half a pallet. Sometimes most of the time it was much smaller, you know, 10 boxes or something like that. But then once we had that, as the day went on, as orders came into the system, every time an order for something reached a Kanban level, a Kanban would print on the shop floor next to the team that made that product. And we had a little hijinka box, you know, little slots, and they would put the Kanban cards in there. And so for the most part, every time Kanban quantity was reached, it wasn't more than a couple of hours after that that we started making that product, right? So, you know, the customer demand was going directly to the shop floor and everybody could see what the demand was. So that, again, that was another cultural step where before when you were in functional department, no one sees the customer. They can't relate to the customer. They're just making to a forecast, you know? And so, I mean, Department A may be making, you know, 200 bases today, and Department B may be making 5,000 covers. Well, that's kind of imbalanced, but they don't know. That's just a forecast. That's what we want you to make. And now when we had the Kanban system and we could print the Kanban cards right at the place where we were making it, everybody saw the customer. And that was a big plus in terms of how do you make the cultural change, because now you could feel the customer. You knew what you were working for.
Well, you know, these value streams that you described, you almost got to argue the people, the team leaders that you put in charge, are almost like mini general managers because you've given them all the tools, the equipment, the people, the resources. You know, I'm sure you moved engineers in there. You had your buyer planners. You basically created five companies within a company and you know, almost a standalone to some degree. Now, you might have had some shared services. But at the end of the day, these are standalone. And what people don't get is that when you give the value stream leader everything possible to satisfy the customer in with quality and everything else, and they don't have to vie for somebody else's services. I had one client that would wait 3 days for the quality guy to come check out their product. And, yeah. and he had his functional boss that he was beholden to. So who signs this check? Not the person asking for the help. Okay. Put them all in that one value stream. And everybody's working towards the same drumbeat, which is, you know, I don't know why that's such a mystery to people. I really don't.
Yeah. I know it's well, and when we did this, I mean, remember we deployed the five operational excellence goals down to the value stream leaders. And one of those operational excellence goals was inventory turns. So the a lot of factories, you know, inventory, once it leaves the factory, they're not responsible for it anymore if they have to send it to a warehouse or something like that. We had a couple of warehouses because we supplied the whole country. We made the value stream leader. They were responsible for inventory turns all the way to the customer, not just out the door in the factory. They were responsible all the way to the customer. So everybody was contacting, you know, and in touch with the customer one way or another. And that, you know, that created a lot of ownership. But you're right. They were like running five or six, you know, I think we had seven value streams leaders, and they were running a little small business. And that's why, you know, even though they sat on the shop floor and basically were doing manufacturing every day, they were running this small business. They had to interface with customers. They had to interface with our sales force. They had to interface with senior management. And so, you know, this was a big responsibility. And it meant that we didn't have to hire somebody with a manufacturing background to be a team leader. We needed someone who could manage people and be smart enough that they could run a company at some point. And that's what we got. And, you know, we had a couple wash out because they, a couple that washed out and we had to put back to what they were doing before was because they couldn't deal with the people. They, you know, we had one team leader that they just looked at the hourly people as below them because they didn't go to college or something. And we said, you know, no, you can't be like that. We're all one team. You know, one of the first things that I did when I got to Waramo was I stopped all the hourly people from wearing ties. Boy, this caused a big uproar. Like, what? You know, how can we, what do you mean we can't wear ties anymore? Because that was a, you know, it was telling everybody that it was like a status symbol, right? I have this tie. And of course the hourly people said, no, all right, look, ties are no good. They cut off circulation to the brain because that's what we see with these guys.
Also dangerous too.
So I got rid of the ties because I said, look, I want you to be respected by your contribution, not by your uniform or what you wear. You know, you're going to be respected by what you contribute to this whole organization. So, you know, you have to earn it that way. So you could walk around wire mold and you wouldn't know who was salaried, who was hourly. You just wouldn't know.
But I don't think I ever told you this story. So when you hired me at Jake Rose in 1987, I think it was May of 87, and you know, I interviewed with Konosaker, of course, and Pentland and all the other guys. Everybody was wearing suit and tie, okay? So I got the job offer, and I said, okay, well, you know, it's a good time to refresh my wardrobe. I went out and bought three suits, ties, the whole works, right? I didn't think I bought new shoes at the time. And I walk in on my first day, 2 weeks later, I have to give my 2 weeks notice. I was working at Ensign Bickford, which is a blasting products company from mining. I walk in with this new, brand new suit on, and I go see George Konosaker, and everybody's wearing polo shirts that say Jake Briggs on them.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
The one that you and I have on right now. And you guys, George, and you bought two blue, two red, two greens for everybody in the factory. Everybody. Hourly. Salary, it didn't matter. So I walk in with this brand new suit, and you had made the change during the 2 weeks I gave my notice. And all of a sudden, I was like, well, I guess I only have a lot of weddings coming up, you know? So, but I don't think I ever told you that story, but yeah, that's a true story. Yeah.
Well, you know, it's.
You owe me some money for that. I mean, I think those suits cost $49. No, back then, anyway.
You know, it's funny when we made that change and we wore the golf shirts and, you know, most of them had your name on it. You know, this is Mark, this is Art, that kind of thing. So my daughter was in high school and I started wearing these golf shirts with my name on it. She's look at, he looks like he works in a gas station. You can, because before that, she always remembered me, you know, as a little girl that I was going out of the house wearing a suit and tie.
Big shot, man. You had the briefcase, the whole thing. Yeah, you know, another funny story I think I never told you. My father was a factory worker, a really good tool and die guy for 44 years at New Britain Machine. And never missed a day of work in his life, by the way, except for when he fought in World War II at the Battle of Iwo Jima. But he said to me, and I was the first to go to college in my family. I grew up in New Britain, Connecticut. And he said, I don't, and this is his exact word, I don't want you to have to go into a GD, rotten, filthy, rotten, stinking shop. I want you to go to college so you can work in an office, right? So, okay, Dad, so I went to college. when you hired me, you know, and I was the CFO, I became the CFO, I moved my whole accounting group to the factory floor.
Yeah.
Everybody. And yeah. I remember Nicole was surprised. Nicole was a money man. He used to call me money man. We were on the factory floor. So I came home one day and I said, Dad, you're not going to believe this. I moved my whole department to the factory floor because you know where we were. We were in the front of that building, in the
Yeah.
up way far away. We didn't have any. We didn't see any pain when we were out of inventory or anything. We just got a report the next day, maybe. And so I got everybody in the shop. I said, "Look, I don't care where you guys go. Go anywhere you want, but you got to be on the floor." So I told my father. He goes, "What are you, nuts?" He said, "You went to college for credit. What the hell are you doing on this factory floor?" I was right by an automatic screw machine, which he worked on. He worked on a New Britain Gridley, right? I was right by a New Britain Gridley. I wanted my desk to be by that machine. And I get sprayed with coolant all the time and everything else. But because back then we had the old ASMs, you know, we were converting over to CNC. But yeah, it was a funny story. I don't think I ever told you that story either. He was like, "What is wrong with you guys? What kind of company are you working for?"
Well, that's, you know, when I got to Wormhole, that was why we put the team leaders out on the shop floor, because of what we had done at Jake Break. And, you know, starting with Pentland in particular out on the shop floor as the head, you know, head of operations, sitting on the shop floor where he could see everything all the time.
Exactly. Pentland had two desks, by the way. He would move around. But that was really fun. All right, you know, a lot of what you talked about here had to do with people.
Yeah.
I mean, almost everything you talked about. You know, we can talk about SMED and equipment and how you do a changeover and with all the standard work, which is incredibly important. We should probably just have an episode on that someday. I know that's one of the chapters in your book, at least one. But everything you talked about was people. And I just love how you said management's job, leadership's job is to their employees to protect their jobs. I know you offered a no layoff policy due to lean improvements, and there's whole strategies behind what you do when you have excess people. Okay, one, put them on Kaizen teams. You can insource, you can do all kinds of stuff. But the other thing, you know, that's what people are so reluctant to do today. They don't want to guarantee no layoffs. And then they wonder why their employee engagement is down. Hey, how can we get people to, they're going to work against you. They're not going to tell you when that machine sounds funny and then it breaks down. They're going to manufacture their own overtime. So you said protecting your people's jobs is one of the leadership responsibilities to their employees. Increase their skills.
Yeah.
Share in the gains. I mean, those three things right there, to me, really help promote the culture that you just described. I mean, without those three things, I don't think you're going to have the, because the second thing you said was, what's in it for me? You have to understand, why would they want to do this? You know, what's in it for them? So the big shots can make more money so that you can fire me, so that you can buy your new, you know, BMW or whatever? No, it's got to be a lot of trust involved, even in the union environment. And as you know, Jake Break was UAW. I know I negotiated a couple of the contracts, and we went to skill blocks and got rid of all those job classifications. And I gave you the data, and it's in my book that you wrote the board to flatline, that we went from, I think, 65 million to 220 million, something like that, with the same headcount.
Yeah.
With the same headcount.
Right.
I mean, and it's all UAW. And I don't know. This stuff works, Art.
Oh, I know. Well, when we're talking about, you know, what's in it for me, one of the things that I thought was great at Wormhole was we had, you know, for the employees, we had two ways to let them share in the wealth. First one was profit sharing. We had a profit sharing plan that we paid out once a quarter. And when I got there, it was paying out at like 1%. And I said, the target is we're going to get that up to 20% of everybody's pay. And we got it up there for a few quarters, but then we would go and buy a new company. And when we bought the company, the money we had to, you know, the interest costs and stuff from borrowing the money to do that, that went against the profit sharing. So profit sharing would come back down. But it averaged probably around 14%, which was meaningful. And then we talked everybody into being in the 401k plan, because we said, you know, that's the profit sharing is your benefit for the short term, but for the long term, we want you to be in the 401k plan so that you can benefit from what the company is doing as we grow and that sort of thing. And so I think we talked about 90% of our people to get into the 401k plan. And when we matched their contribution with Wiremo stock, even though we were a private company, we did value the stock every year. And so we matched it with Wiremo stock. And when we sold the company, the biggest shareholder was the 401k plan. So all of the employees that had, shares from that 401k plan, they created the gains. They got the biggest part of the gain at the end of the day. So I thought that was just perfect. They were getting a good profit sharing as we went through. And then when we sold the company, they got the biggest share of the gains because they're the ones that created those gains, really, when you think of it.
You did that though. This is not like something that's going on today. You did that back in the 90s,
Yeah.
right? It was like early to late 90s, all this stuff happened. And that's kind of cutting edge back then in terms of that. Art, when I look at what you talked about, let me just review a couple of things here for people to think about. I love your definition of culture. It's just the way we do things here, okay?
Right.
And it's got to be consistent. Leaders got to walk the talk, as you said. Leaders must lead. I don't know how many times I had a CEO tell me, "Let me introduce you to John, my lean guy. He's responsible for implementing lean." Okay, right there, I know they're dead, right in the water, dead in the water. So what's in it for me? You had understandable goals. By the way, key word there is understandable, okay? On-time delivery, 100%, 20% productivity improvements per year, 50% defects per year, reduction in defects, I should say, 20 inventory turns, and then you had these whole 5S visual management requirements as a, might be more of a qualitative goal as opposed to a quantifiable goal. You changed the org structure and you moved to value streams, and you did that by product family. You created a KPO office, and one of the mistakes we made at Danaher early on when I started the Danaher Business System is a lot of our factories put the least common denominator in those positions of the KPO office, the Kaizen promotion office, and they didn't put iPods in there. Okay, they did not put up and coming, because you want your people of the future, your leaders of the future, to really understand this stuff. And that's how you really drive the culture. Okay. You did Kaizen 2 per week, which is a pretty healthy number. Everybody had to participate in Kaizen. It wasn't just factory, it was salaried, it was everybody. And you mixed up the teams where you had people actually from all walks of life, from finance, from engineering, from marketing, sales, in operations. Learn by doing is a really big deal because, again, you can't learn. I know you're a golfer. You can't learn how to hit a golf ball just by watching Tiger Woods, right? You got to do it. You had core values that you described, and the focus was over people, customer, and Kaizens. Focus on processes, not results. Processes will get you the results. So many companies today focus on the results. And that's like looking at the bathroom scale to try to lose weight without focusing on things like calories, without focusing on things like nutrition, sleep, exercise. They just look at the scale, and you're not going to get it that way. And a lot of times that scale is cost. People just look at cost, and that's a lagging indicator. Cost is a result, as you described, of doing the right thing with process, and that drives it, right? You created a code of conduct, which I think is phenomenal. Okay. And you made sure people, modeled those behaviors that we all decided were the codes of conduct, which, by the way, goes back to your culture. It's how we, not only how we do things around here, it's how we behave. Okay. You had to weed out the bad actors, and there always are going to be some bad actors, unfortunately, that will hold you down if you don't do that. You had weekly reviews with your team leaders in terms of how they're doing, what Kaizens are going to be doing, all that kind of stuff, right? So that's my notes anyway, which I'm gonna get these typed up because these things seem to be the roadmap to be able to drive a lean culture, and I think it's phenomenal. And hey, look, this isn't just MBA stuff, right? I know you're an MBA from Babson. This is not MBA stuff. This is stuff that you did and it worked.
Right.
It actually worked.
And there's a chapter in the book about this, the how do you create a lean culture, that gives you even a little bit more detail, a little more things that I didn't say. But yeah, it, I mean, if you understand that lean is all about people, that's what you're trying to change, is the people, you know, because to me, companies are only just a, and this is any company, it's nothing more than a collection of people, a bunch of processes trying to deliver value to a customer. That's all any company really is, right? And so if you can change the processes, you're going to give more value to the customer. And in order to change the processes, you've got to change the people. You've got to get them to see things differently, think differently, and be focused on changing those processes. I mean, look at Toyota today. They're 60 years into this, and they're still doing Kaizen, Kaizen, Kaizen. And they're trying to change processes that, you know, maybe they took a setup reduction from 2 hours down to 30 seconds. They want to get it to 10 seconds. You know, that's the way that they think. And that, if you can't change your thinking like that, you never have a chance at this, really. I mean, I remember Nakao, we took injection molding presses at Wiremol from about a 2.5 hour changeover, you know, with a crane, an overhead crane. We side loaded them. We got them down to where it could be done in about a minute and a half. Okay. From 2.5 hours to a minute and a half. Nakao comes in and looks at it and he says, okay, no good. Next step, I want you to be able to do the changeover during the time when the ram comes back to make the next injection. When it comes back, I want the mold to change and the new injection is in the new mold. Within the time of the molding press itself, which, you know, it'll be maybe 15, 20 seconds from the time it goes out to the time it comes in. Now, in fairness, we understood how to do that. You know, we said it's, we could have, like, come on, Nick, how, you know, we're in a minute and a half here. But no, I mean, that's the way you have to think is, all right, you got to a minute and a half. Now what's next? Where do you go next? That's culture. When you can think that way and everybody, no one questions that and everybody thinks, okay, that makes sense. Then you've really created the culture, right? You've really created a culture that is going to be really hard to beat from anybody. And I mean, Toyota's not going to go out and hire some guy from Boeing to run Toyota like Ford did. You know, it'll all come internally, because unless you've lived lean and spent a few years in your career on the shop floor at Toyota, you know, you're not going to know anything. You're never going to have a chance to go higher. So, but that's the culture, right? That's the kind of culture you want to create, I think.
And just talk just for a moment before we close up here, the importance of driving problem solving and improvements in Kaizen down to the people who do the work.
I think that's probably the most important thing of all, because first of all, the people who do the work, they know what the problems are. They're going to have the best solutions to those problems. It's just that no one's ever listened to them before, right? I mean, when we started the President's Kaizen at Danaher, and we'd go in for 3 days with all our presidents, and we'd make big changes in 3 days. When we first got there, the hourly employees would say, look, we're really impressed that you would bring all your presidents here for 3 days to try and help us improve. But we've been working here for 20 years, and you're never going to change anything in 3 days. After 3 days, they would say, hey, you're not going to go away and leave us with them, are you? Which meant what they were really saying is the people who've never listened to us before. All you did in 3 days was listen to us and do what we said. And so it's the hourly people that really know. They know the job. They know what's possible. I mean, I gave you the example of going from 3 hours and 10 minutes to 1 minute on a 150-ton punch press. Most of the bright ideas for that came from the operators. You know, they said, gee, I got to climb up this ladder to do this, you know. Okay, let's eliminate that. I have to climb under the machine here to do that. Let's eliminate that. You know, I have to use 4 different wrenches. Let's just get down to 1 wrench. All those kind of things. Those came from the operator. Those weren't some engineer telling them what to do. That was working together with the operator, and the operator saying, here's the things that bother me. So, yeah, I think it's critical. I think, but it's an example of, you know, most functional companies, when they're going to solve problems or whatever, they're going to use the same 40 or 50 people over and over to get involved in solving problems. If I got 1,000 employees and I only use 40 or 50 to solve problems, the company that uses all 1,000 employees to solve problems is going to beat me to death. So I think that's the whole thing. You want to use all your people. You can't say just because they didn't go to college or something doesn't mean they're not as smart as the guys who did. They have different skills, and you know, they're smart people, and nobody wants to go to work and do a bad job, pretty much. I mean, they all want to go and feel like they contributed something, and it was great. But for most companies, after a while, no one listens to you, then you just go to work and do what you're told, and you know, you need the paycheck, et cetera. When you change that around to where you're on a Kaizen, we're asking you for your ideas, you're participating, that's a whole different world. That's a different place. It's a different way to do things.
It's fun. It's a lot of fun.
Yeah.
You look forward to it. I'll tell you a quick little anecdote. I had a client, and they had this one plant. They had several plants, but this one plant, I took to the VP of operations, saying, how come you guys aren't doing any Kaizens at that plant? The people there are really, they've been there 30, 40 years. They're just set in their ways. They're not going to change. Really? So you come with me. And I took them to the plant. And I said, I just want you to observe this. I walked up to one of the guys there. And I said to him, one of the operators, says, hey, how you doing? And I introduced myself. I told him my father was a cool die guy and all this stuff. And, you know, and I knew something about the equipment. And I said to him, hey, by the way, I said, has anybody ever asked you for your ideas? Never. Really? Well, if I were to ask you to give me one or two things that you would do differently in this area, what would it be? Well, I tell you right now, I moved that over there. I put that over here. We moved this. And he gave me like 10 things. Okay.
Yeah.
And I walked away with this VP. I said, you're going to get this guy because none of this crap is documented. It's all tribal knowledge right now. You better get this guy and hire him as a consultant or something. I don't know what, but he's got more ideas how to make this place better than Carter has killed. Okay? And you were just writing him off because he's been here too long and he's set in his ways. I think you're set in your ways, okay, in terms of how you think. My God. I mean, this guy was a treasure chest of ideas. And he lit up when I asked him. Like he got excited. Like, he's not excited. This guy got, you know. And I don't know. I really appreciate the fact that how people oriented your approach is. And I'm not saying it's missing everywhere, but it is missing in most places.
Yeah. Well, so people drive everything. I mean, they're, you know, but people are people, so they're different, and they can be difficult to deal with. But if you can get them engaged in something and get them working on something as a team, you know, if you're on a team, you want the team to win, right? It's just human nature. It's kind of, you know, if you go to a football game, let's say, and you're 10 minutes late getting in, and by the time you, once you get in your seat, the first thing you do, look at the scoreboard. What did I miss? What's the score? You know, so when we had production control boards at every cell, it said hour by hour, what are we supposed to do versus what did we do? And then we had a reason for why we didn't do it. It doesn't take long for the whole team to get on board with that. And they're going to, you know, they said, okay, if we're supposed to do 10 every hour, let's look at, you know, when at the end of the hour, we post it. They all look at it. Okay, well, we got to work a little faster next hour because we missed by one or something like that. Because they're on a team and that's the scoreboard, right? And they're looking at the scoreboard. And It's really a powerful tool, the visual control part.
Well, that's your fifth metric, if you will, call it a metric. It's, you know, you had your on-time delivery, you had your productivity defects and inventory turns, but that fifth one was just what you described as the five things that you deployed as goals. And that's phenomenal. And nice and simple, too. You know, it doesn't have to be complex. So. All right, any last thoughts here? We're going to meet again in another month or so to talk about the early days of Danaher. That might be a long one. I've got so many war stories, and I'm sure you do too. But the early days of Danaher are going to be kind of fun and to talk about and reminisce with. So, last word to you, my friend.
Well, thank you for having me. And I just would refer people to the new book, The Lean Turnaround Answer Book, because there's a big article on this subject in there. But there's also, articles on all kinds of questions that people have about lean. What do I do about this? Why is standard work important? Why is pull important? All of those kind of fundamental things. So I think people could learn a lot and answer a lot of the questions that they have before they talk themselves out of things. They should look and see an answer to their question. They're going to find it in this book. So I appreciate you having me. And, you know, I think talking about lean culture is a very important one. I think a lot of people will be interested in the early days of Danaher because all the things we did there that created what Danaher is today are things that they should be thinking about and doing themselves. So hopefully we can get more people going down the lean path, and hopefully this podcast will help do that. So thank you very much.
That's kind of do our, and I do appreciate you coming on. And again, I'm holding up a book called The Lean Turnaround Answer Book. Now, this is after your first two books, The Lean Turnaround and The Lean Turnaround Workbook, okay? Those are unbelievable books as well. And this answer book, I was going through it, and, you know, as you know, I've been doing this since 1987. And I'm looking at this book and I'm paging through it the other day, and there's stuff in there. I got to read that chapter, or I got to read that one, you know, because there's good stuff in here. So, and you can get this on Amazon. Is that what
it's on? Yeah, Amazon? It's on Amazon. The hardcover version is Amazon. And then they also, it's on Kindle as an electronic version as well.
Okay. I got it. And I have my signed copy right here. So thank you very much for that. And Art, we will see you next time on the next podcast episode when we talk about Danaher lean culture. There's so much other things that we should have you back on because there's so much to talk about. I mean, this is endless. But I do appreciate your time. And when I get to Boston, which I probably will be over the next couple of months, I will look you up. And I know you can make me buy dinner again. So that's okay. I'll do that.
That's right. I'm saving up.
Save your appetite. Save up your appetite. Yeah, I'm going to have a nice big lobster in Boston because we don't do that well here in Arizona. Okay, so.
All right. Well, okay. Take care.
Thank you. Okay.
Thanks for listening to the Lean 911 podcast. I'll be happy to address your questions or feedback on future episodes. Email me at mark@lean911.com. You can check out our other episodes by visiting our website at lean911.com, our YouTube channel, wherever you listen to podcasts. This is your host, Mark DeLuzio. Thanks for listening.